Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. September 10th marks World Suicide Prevention Day, and Kids Help Phone wants you to know the signs and symptoms of someone contemplating suicide as well as the resources out there. Four First Nation communities in Ontario's Ring of Fire area have signed an agreement with each other to pursue ownership and preferred development in their area. A community in northwestern Ontario has passed a water declaration and community consultation protocol to protect land in their traditional territory, and Métis people were among the early fashionistas in the country creating beautiful clothing based on their identity. That and more being taught in a Métis studies class offered in BC. Plus, imagine surviving leukemia and several rounds of chemotherapy, radiation, and a bone marrow transplant. Meet a man who did just that and who also was able to meet his bone marrow donor from across the world. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. World Suicide Prevention Day falls on September 10th. Kids Help Phone wants parents to understand youth suicide. Caitlin Parsons with Kids Help Phone says there are plenty of resources out there to help people.
Well, firstly, we want people to know that there are different resources out there for individuals who may be dealing with, you know, depression or any other sort of mental illness that may be causing them to want to end their life. So because of that, we, you know, definitely tell them that the resources are that are available to them, who they can go to for help, what they can do, what their friends can do if they have a friend or they know somebody who is contemplating suicide, so that they have access to different resources.
Kids Help Phone says suicide rates of Aboriginal youth are 8 times higher than the national rate for females and 5 times higher than the national rate for males. Kids Help Phone has been working to gain an understanding of the realities that Aboriginal youth are facing. According to the Canadian Mental Health Association, there are several factors that contribute to poor mental health, including housing shortages, colonization, residential school trauma, and discrimination. The National Aboriginal Health Organization has suicide prevention resources available on their Honoring Life Network website. The organization will also be hosting its annual conference, Dialogue for Life, at the end of November in Montreal. RCMP are investigating a shooting in Hobima. APTN reports a woman was shot and killed on the Samson Cree First Nation south of Edmonton. RCMP say the 23-year-old woman was shot September 5th early in the morning. Police also say the shooting happened next door to where a child, Ethan Yellowbird, was killed on July 11th when a bullet passed through his bedroom. The child was the grandson of Chief Marvin Yellowbird. Police told media that it's too soon to speculate whether the shootings are linked, but says investigators aren't ruling out the possibility. The community has been battling gang-related violence, and there have been no arrests in this latest shooting. Four First Nations in the Ring of Fire area of Northern Ontario have signed an agreement together. The signed document is a collaborative agreement to pursue ownership, development, and operations in the East-West Corridor in the Ring of Fire. Abenamik First Nation Chief Roger Oskanigish hopes a unified voice will mean more ownership over development in the territory.
We're going to have a strong voice. We'll be stronger by putting things together, and also we are looking for an ownership on the corridor. That means we'll try and see if we could own the railroad. I mean, not the railroad, the road, the all-weather road, and also the transmission that's going to go in there. And also, we're thinking about the fiber optic line, also from Bell Alliance, that we would like to see.
Oskanigish says the agreement is very important to enable them to be a part of the Ring of Fire rather than being stepped on. He adds First Nations participating in the agreement each have their own community consultation protocols. Roseau River First Nation is going to launch a lawsuit against the federal government over education funding. The Winnipeg Free Press reports the chief of the Manitoba community was going to shut down its school this year, but decided to sue the federal government instead. Chief Terrence Nelson told media he's going to launch the lawsuit to force the federal government to provide First Nation schools with the same level of funding as public schools. Nelson says the band has made a deal with Manitoba First Nations Education Resource Center and the federal government to send three staffers to the community school this year as a pilot project. Kachinameku Sibininawag is looking after their land. The community has passed two documents, a water declaration and a community consultation protocol. KI spokesperson John Cutfeet says the documents come after the fact that the community has tried everything in Canadian law to keep a handle on development in their territory.
We tried to use the established mechanisms of the country, if you will, and society to try and ensure that there is a respectful way of dealing with Kachinameku Sibininawag as it comes to development or proposals in the KI homeland. We ended up having our effort disregarded by both levels of government, which resulted in the incarceration of our leadership and which resulted in hardship to the community and which resulted in a company being authorized to come into our territory without our consent and without interference from us. So we tried to live within the means of the established mechanism, the instruments that are recognized by society, in order to gain fairness and justice. When that did not happen, we had to revert back to the natural law that governs Kachinameku Sibininawag, which is called Niganawendandake. And Niganawendandake is the ultimate law that is provided to Kachinameku Sibininawag to protect and keep the land.
KI passed its water declaration and community protocol by referendum in early July. Comox First Nation on Vancouver Island has formed a partnership with the Comox Valley Project Watershed Society to protect and preserve the Courtney River Estuary. The two groups, along with the National Historic Site Committee, have launched a bid for national historic status of the site for the ancient Aboriginal fish trap systems in the estuary. The Comox Valley Record also reports an archaeologist and geologist have proven that the river contains the remains of thousands of wooden stakes. The find suggests the area was home to an extensive fishery using fish trap systems. A third anniversary vigil for missing Maniwaki members Maisie Ojik and Shannon Alexander was held earlier this month. The two were last seen September 5, 2008 in Maniwaki, Quebec. Maisie was 15 when she went missing and Shannon was 16. The family of Maisie Ojik told media that police have several leads in the three-year-old case. The vigil was held in Maniwaki on September 5th. Native American activist Leonard Peltier has been awarded the first ever Mario Benedetti Foundation International Human Rights Prize. Peltier has been behind bars for more than 30 years after he was sentenced for killing two FBI agents in 1977. The foundation says the political prisoner was awarded the prize because Peltier is a symbol of resistance to repressive state policies by the United States, where there are people in jail for ethnic, racial, and religious reasons. The award honors the name of the Uruguayan journalist and writer who died in 2009. A Mohawk man has filed a complaint with the Human Rights Tribunal. Larry Hay alleges he was fired by the OPP for speaking out against racism in policing. The Toronto Star reports Hay is also the former police chief on Tiendanega Mohawk Territory, a community near Belleville, Ontario. He says he was fired by former OPP chief Julian Fantino because he spoke honestly to a journalism student about the racism he experienced in his more than two decades of policing. OPP declined to comment on the case. A hearing is scheduled for September 13th to the 15th in Kingston. The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs is concerned about First Nations children who have been displaced by flooding in the province. In a statement, Grand Chief Derek Nepinak says he's worried about the children's access to a safe and quality education environment. And it may take a few more weeks until children from Lake St. Martin are able to return to school. Plus, the children weren't able to complete their education in the last school year because of early spring flooding. The Grand Chief is calling on the federal government to work with the community of Lake St. Martin to ensure the children are able to return to a safe and supportive school as soon as possible. A Métis Studies program is being offered at the College of New Caledonia in Prince George, B.C. Kim Stewart, faculty member, says the Métis Studies program will look at Métis identity based on historical commercial products. She says Métis women had a big role in the fashion industry in this country.
Well, one of the really interesting things about Métis people, especially for the women, is that they were outfitting and creating clothing for not only for their families, but for some of the early leaders in Canadian history. And so it was a way of being able to provide for their families, but also an expression that combined First Nations fashions and clothing with the European styles.
Stewart adds the voices of Métis elders are included in the curriculum. Dave Takaro Jr. survived two rounds of chemotherapy and six rounds of full-body radiation and a bone marrow transplant after he was diagnosed with an aggressive type of leukemia 5 years ago. Takaro was also lucky enough to meet the man who donated his bone marrow to him. The donor lives in Germany, and Takaro was grateful to meet him and receive that transplant.
Waited in the terminal for about 3 hours because it was just so slow. And then when he walked through, it was just, I can't describe the feeling. It was just overwhelming of excitement and joy and gratitude and happiness. It was incredible.
In order to live through a disease like leukemia, Takaro says attitude is key.
You just got to live day to day and know that you're better than the disease, that you can get through it, and know that, just know that, you know, there's always good days, and just to enjoy what you have. And know that, you know, life is a beautiful thing and it is a definite gift and it is worth fighting for.
Takaro also encourages people to donate blood and bone marrow because it means saving someone else's life. Takaro is a member of the Miccosu Cree Nation and lives in California. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Child, you lie awake at night, hearing voices calling. My child, you fear the pale night, memories recalling. Why do you cry? Why do you die? Wings that cannot fly. angel, little angel, face of frown, eyes that cannot cry.
With Little Angel. September 10th marks World Suicide Prevention Day. It's a tough issue to talk about, but it's something we have to talk about. And Kids Help Phone is talking about it and trying to raise awareness around suicide prevention, including where to find resources, signs and symptoms of someone who is considering suicide, and also the cultural sensitivity training the organization has been undertaking to understand mental health issues in First Nation communities. Here's Kids Help Phone counselor Caitlin Parsons.
Well, it's a day that we raise awareness around the issue of suicide and really bring it to the forefront, letting people know that it is not something that only happens once in a while, but it is actually, you know, very present and very prevalent in a lot of different communities. So we usually bring on this day a time where we're talking about it to make people aware that it is going on and how to identify people that may be at risk.
And for your awareness, what do you want people to know?
Well, firstly, we want people to know that there are different resources out there for individuals who may be dealing with, you know, depression or any other sort of mental illness that may be causing them to want in their life. And because of that, we, you know, definitely tell them that the resources are that are available to them, who they can go to for help, what they can do, what their friends can do if they have a friend or they know somebody who is contemplating suicide, so that they have access to different resources.
Okay, and what about youth? What are the statistics for youth suicide in the country?
Well, the World Health Organization, says approximately 3,000 people per year commit suicide. Now, that's globally, but we do know that the number is much higher than that because those are the only suicides that have been reported or it's actually been documented, but there's other, obviously, other suicides that occur as well that people may not be aware of, things that are considered accidental deaths. So because of that, that number is actually far larger than 3,000. And they say for every one full suicide, there is 20 other people that will attempt it. So we do know that the rates of attempt are way greater than the amount of people that complete it.
Okay, and I understand that Aboriginal youth suicide is significantly higher than the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true. You know, in studies and, you know, different researches that not only our organization has done, but in other organizations such as what I mentioned, the World Health Organization, they do say that in Aboriginal reserves, Aboriginal youth are more likely, or that there is a high for Aboriginal youth for many different reasons. It could be to do to the isolation of communities, possibly. It could do to anything to do with the upbringing of that child, their parents, anything to do with some friend issues, witnessing other youth who have committed suicide, feeling like they have no resources, no way out, maybe no access to resources in their community specifically. So because of that, they may not be getting the help they need right away. So because of that, I mean, all these different factors put in together, I mean, unfortunately, these youth are definitely at higher risk.
And so I also understand that Kids Help Phone has been doing something to help youth in Aboriginal communities.
We have weekly and definitely monthly training for all counselors at Kids Help Phone around specific topics. I mean, not only suicide, but every other topic that we may encounter, you know, for a kid calling us, something that they may be going through. For suicide in particular, we do counseling, you know, any youth that calls us. If we do get a call from a youth from an Aboriginal reserve and they're calling us, or even just an Aboriginal youth that is living, you know, maybe in the city somewhere, you know, and they're talking about some issues that they may be facing, our main goal is to try to find them help. And so in talking with them, we kind of explore some of the reasons why they may feel like this is an option or why they may feel like they have, you know, nothing left to live for. We kind of explore that and try to make a safety plan. And through that safety plan, we can access different resources because we do have a database. And if they're willing to give us their information, such as their location, their age, their name, that sort of thing, we do provide different services. We can send them an ambulance or send them help to get them either to a hospital or somewhere where they're going to be safe that night.
Okay, and I know not everybody knows what the signs and symptoms are of somebody wanting to commit suicide. And can you tell us what some of those signs and symptoms are?
Yeah, for sure. Withdrawn behavior, that would be a big sign. So someone who is keeping to themselves a lot, they may be fairly moody, they may get angry very easily. They may be saying certain things that would lead you to think that there's something going on. I mean, such as, you know, it's not worth it anymore, no one's going to notice me when I'm gone. You know, really, really just sad things that they may be saying, feeling like, you know, there's no one that's really going to care about them, so why not do it anyways? And it's that kind of talk, that really negative talk that you have to be careful of. And then again, you know, the symptoms, you know, again, it is linked to mental health. So, you know, if someone's experiencing depression or they're just depression that runs in the family as well, you know, that person may be at higher risk as well. So watching out for, you know, different things. If they, you know, used to enjoy a certain activity and now they don't do it anymore and they're keeping to themselves, they're isolating themselves, not talking to their friends anymore, not participating in these things, then, you know, that's a clear sign as well that there may be something going on. And that's when, you know, as parents and as, you know, other people that are looking after that kid or, you know, just know that person, you know, it'd be up to them to approach them to make sure everything is okay and, you know, to encourage them to get help if it's not okay. And, you know, as a bystander, if you know that this person has been contemplating suicide or has made, you know, any attempts or has, you know, a plan in mind, it is, you know, your job, you know, as someone who's bystanding to encourage them to get help or get them help if they cannot get it themselves.
That was Caitlin Parsons, a counselor with Kids Help Phone. Kitchinemeku Sibininawag is looking after their land. The community has passed two documents, a water declaration and a community consultation protocol. KI spokesperson John Cutfeet tells us about those documents.
On July 5, 2011, exactly 82 years after the adhesion to Treaty No. 9 was signed in Kitchinemeku Sibininawag, the community of KI held a referendum on two documents. One was the consultation protocol, and one was the water declaration. Now, the water declaration says that that it covers 13,000 square kilometers of lakes, rivers, and forests and wetlands in the KI homeland. It also includes our lake, which is the Kitchinemeku-Sibininawag Lake, 661 square kilometers, and it says that all the waters that flow in and out of Kitchinemeku-Sibik and all those waters that flow from those lakes and rivers and wetlands are deemed to be protected under the KI authority. And that means that any type of development will have to go through the KI processes to determine whether they are detrimental or are beneficial to Kitchinemeku-Sibininawag. And that essentially is the KI Water Declaration.
And so what made the community decide to do this?
Kitchinemeku-Sibininawag, just to give you a little background, when in February 2006, we found this drilling company in our territory, at least 40 kilometers to the south of us, about to embark on a drilling program armed with a permit from the government of Ontario, and they were about to embark on this program without the knowledge of the community and without the consent of the community. Now, from 2006 on, we were engaged in court litigation with the company, as well as the government of Ontario. And one of the concerns that we had with the drilling program that was happening in that territory was that there is a river system that feeds into the main lake, which we live on. And the claims that they were wanting to explore would require the removal of huge amounts of rock and overburden to get at the mineral that they were searching for. And to do so, to get at the mineral, they would have to do some form of acid rock drainage, which would go into the river system, which would eventually flow into our lake. So it was a very environmentally sensitive area. On top of that, they did not fully discharge the obligations they had to us under the Supreme Court rulings of accommodation, consultation and accommodation. Even though we had a consultation protocol in place, they went ahead and just, Ontario just went ahead and gave authorization for the drilling program to continue without our knowledge. Now, over the years, as we were engaged in the court litigation process, we eventually could not continue to afford to be in the court process. So KI left the court system, saying that we could no longer afford it. But at the end of that day, when KI left the court, the judge ruled that the company had immediate access to the territory and we were prevented from interfering with that drilling program. As a result of that, KI said there is no access to the company. And to make a long story short, eventually members of Ksamek Sabininok leadership, known as the KI-6, were found in contempt of that court ruling of October 2007, which allowed immediate access to the territory by the company. And in March 17, 2008, the KI-6 were sentenced to 6 months of incarceration for civil contempt. So through that time, there were discussions between Ontario and the company on access to the territory. But KI was adamant that there would be no access without its consent. So in May of 2008, there was a Court of Appeal hearing with respect to the incarcerating of our leadership. And the Court of Appeal ruled at that time that the KI-6 were to be released to time served and that incarceration would be the last resort in conflicts like these. What they said was there was a duty to negotiate in good faith on the part of the Crown to make sure that the Aboriginal interests were reconciled with other competing interests. So as a result of that, while the leadership were incarcerated, there were discussions on how to further protect the territories. So one of the things was to begin putting documents in place that were from KI, that were from the membership of KI, on how to deal with people from the outside wanting to develop in the Ksamek Sabininok homeland, and also how do we protect our waters. And that's where the KI Water Declaration came from, as well as the KI Consultation Protocol, because of that ruling in May 2008, which says that our interests have to be reconciled with other competing interests. And those documents that KI passed in July 5, 2011 are then our interests which have to be reconciled with other competing interests. Just to give you a little background on where those, how those documents came to be.
That was John Cutfeet, spokesperson for Kitchenamaycusibinawag. Now here's Proud Métis from Arlette.
Howling wolf on a moonlit night spins a tail gone from inside of them before the white man came. Children playing on a summer's day, the black-robed men took them all away. He cries out their names, and laughter fills the woods no more. A wailing child hungry at the door. He yearns for the ways. My spirit's alive and my body's well. All of the ancients cast a spell and protected me from lies. Oh, my parents ran and took my brother and me. They were determined we would be free and be proud Métis. Old and gray, the wolf survives this brief decay. He teaches others, he shows them the way. Respect the women, protect the young. That's the tale the wolf has sung. People thrive on this rebirth. We'll burn the sweet grass and smoke the pit. Be fierce but peaceful. Stand up for right in the sweat lodge on a moonlit night. Ooh, my parents ran and took my brother and me. They were determined we would be free and be proud Métis, proud Métis, proud Métis.
Métis Studies course is being offered at the College of New Caledonia in Prince George, BC. It's based on Métis identity and has a lot of input from Métis elders in the community. Kim Stewart is a faculty member of the college and helped put the course together.
Métis Studies 2 is a study of Métis identity based on or by looking at the material culture of Métis people. So we're basically going to be looking at and recreating some of the beadwork and moose hair tuftings and things like that, and then looking at Métis identity as it connects to these commercial products that they were making at the time.
Okay, why don't you tell us a little bit more about Métis identity and how it connects to those?
Well, one of the really interesting things about Métis people, especially for the women, is that they were outfitting and creating clothing for not only for their families, but for some of the early leaders in Canadian history. And so it was a way of being able to provide for their families, but also an expression that combined First Nations fashions and clothing with the European styles.
So it was all meshed, and I understand that the course also incorporates teachings from Métis elders. And do you want to tell us about that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, what we did was we tried to stay ethnographically in the area of Prince George. So we had a group of Métis elders that we came in and interviewed, and also they gave us demonstrations of the skills that they had with moose and caribou hair tufting, horsehair wrapping, beadwork. And weaving of sashes. So basically, the students, we are learning online, but the students will have an opportunity to view different videos of elders doing their work, and they'll also see me as though they were in a classroom. Each student will get their own little kit that has some materials that they can create a sampler from, so that they can see what it was like to actually create these materials and work with these materials.
So when you were creating the program, did you consult with the Métis elders on the curriculum?
Oh, absolutely. They were there all the way. And there's such a huge amount of knowledge there. The wonderful thing with elders is you just have to sit down with a cup of tea, you know, and start visiting, and all this amazing material comes out. And So we did that, but we also had the video camera rolling at the same time, and the result is basically like sitting in the living room with your elders having conversations. It's awesome.
Great. And what did they think about the course?
Oh, they're so excited to be able to share this information, especially see it be passed on to young people. I think one of the frustrations sometimes for our elders in this area is they feel like no one is listening to them and that no one cares. So this is a way for them to reach out way beyond our own geographic area and have the information be known and not be forgotten and be taken seriously.
Now tell me how the online portion works.
Well, with the online portion, it's a 15-week course, and it's offered through CNC. And there is a virtual classroom that you sign up, and you can go on any time, day or night, and you don't have to be geographically located near us. So that's the beauty of it. And basically, they will see videos of myself introducing topics and lectures, and then they have an opportunity to look through a variety of materials that I've assembled for them, part of that being the videos that we did with the elders as well. And then they keep an intellectual journal in which they can record the responses to the material that they're looking at.
Sounds very cool. And why is a course like this important?
You know, people have asked me that, and I have to say that I really believe that the art and the technology from the past is going to become very, very important for the future, because it's based on a model that is sustainable with the Earth. And one of the things that all of us want going forward is to look after our Earth. And so I think it's important to sift through some of the things that we know from the past, bring them forward, and mesh them with what we know today so that we can, live more in tune with Earth.
That was Kim Stewart, faculty member at the College of New Caledonia. Four First Nations in Ontario's north have signed agreement together to pursue ownership and preferred development in the area known as the Ring of Fire. The area is home to rich mining resources, and it's also the hot topic during the Ontario provincial elections in full swing right now. Roger Oskaginish is the chief of Nibinamik, one of the signatory First Nations in the new agreement.
We've been talking about this agreement for a while, for some time. The first initial agreement that we did was back in March of 2010, and where we signed as four chiefs from Nishkandaga Chief, Yamatun Chief, and also Webkwe First Nation Chief, and also myself. We signed an agreement initially on March of 2010. And after that, we decided to make it official. That's why we had the signing ceremony today.
And how exactly did this agreement come about?
Well, one of the things years ago, we always talked about working together, and we always talked about in our area, shared territory, if the infrastructure or development comes in our area, we should try and be working together instead of just individual First Nations. And that was a goal that was set from our past leaders, and that's what we're doing by.
And it was because of development that you didn't like or didn't want in the territory, correct?
No, we don't oppose development. We like to have it happen, but we like to be the ones to have a say on it. We want government and industry to know that this is our traditional territory, and we like to be part of it.
And where exactly is the corridor that this runs through where you signed the agreement?
Well, this is an east-west corridor. This corridor will come out of Pickle Lake Gravel Road. There's a gravel road north of Pickle Lake, and just past the gravel road on probably about 75 kilometers north of Pickle Lake. That's where the corridor will start. And it'll go to about 20 kilometers south of Webequay. It's called Webequay Junction. And that thing is about 230, 240 kilometers.
Okay. And so what does this agreement mean for the communities that it affects?
Well, this agreement, like I said, it's just like we're working together. And then and as a unity, like with these four First Nations, we're going to have a stronger voice. We'll be stronger by putting things together. And also, we are looking for an ownership on the corridor. That means we'll try and see if we could own the railroad. I mean, not the railroad, the road, the all-weather road, and also the transmission that's going to go in there. And also, we're thinking about the fiber optic line, also from Bell Alliance. That we would like to see.
Mm. And how important is this agreement to Ring of Fire communities?
It's very important to us because we like to be part of the Ring of Fire rather than being stepped on all the time. We like to have a say on it, and by signing this agreement as four First Nations, we will be sharing a lot of information to one another. And one of the other things that we have is we have individually, First Nations have their own access protocols on how industry and government will come to our table.
And what will it mean to industry and government?
I think that's what the industry is looking for. They need to see somebody they can talk to, I guess. Right now, where it stands, they don't really know who they're going to go to. But with this signing of this for First Nation agreement, at least, let's say, Noront, as an example, will know who they can deal with now.
That was Roger Oskaginish, Chief of Nibinamik First Nation in Northern Ontario. Now here's Derek Miller with Music is the Medicine.
You got to give them and praises to this unknown. Shout out all your love above this unknown. Give him all your love. I'm telling you so. This unknown. This unknown. Music is the medicine of my soul. Whoa. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. Unknown. Shine that light in your heart. This I know. Before you fall apart, I'm telling you so. This I know. Yeah. This I know. Music is the medicine of my soul. Whoa. Music is the medicine of my soul. Whoa. Music is the medicine of my soul. Whoa.
Imagine living through 2 rounds of chemotherapy, 6 rounds of full body radiation, an addiction to painkillers, a bone marrow transplant, and 2 more diseases. Dave Takaro, a Cree man who lives in California, did just that. He went through all of that after being diagnosed with an aggressive form of leukemia about 5 years ago, and Dave has been incredibly grateful for his bone marrow transplant, and recently he's been able to meet that donor. I'll let him tell you about it.
Yeah, it was incredible. I had a lot of anticipation, you know, building up to it, and very anxious and nervous, and finally, you know, we got to LAX yesterday, and waited in the terminal for, 3 hours, because it was just so slow. And then when he walked through, it was just, can't describe the feeling. It was just overwhelming of excitement and joy and gratitude and happiness. It was incredible.
So who is the donor, or are you allowed to say?
His name is Christian. He's from Germany.
So how are you able to track him down and meet with him?
Oh, okay, this was a process. In Germany, I think it's called the DKMS. He went to them and, you know, to do the bone marrow and all that. And then I obviously was in Canada and Vancouver. And he had to go to the DKMS after 2 years and say he would like to meet me. And I had to go to the Canadian bone marrow donor office place. And they said, yes, wait for 2 years as well. And after that, if you want to meet them, you write a letter and all that, and it will come about. But, you know, I was doing my best after 2 years to meet with them, and it was just like a lot of red tape, and it just took a long time. But after, you know, 4 years, it happened. So, you know, it's more just a lot of waiting. It's a very big waiting game, but on both sides. It's just, there's a lot of stuff, I guess, they have to go through, and make sure that everything is in right, you know, correct standing, that I survived the bone marrow transplant and that I'm, you know, going through it, and just to make sure that, you know, they tell the donor that it actually worked for the recipient.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it was a really long process. And so really, was it worth the wait? And what was Christian like?
Oh, hell yeah, it was definitely well worth the wait. You know, I mean, I wish it could have happened sooner, but you know what? I mean, patience is, you know, makes it a lot better at the end. And Christian is an awesome guy. You know, he took the time out of his life to donate marrow to me and save my life. So, I mean, it was something, you know, menial to him, but saved my life. And, you know, I think, you know, this guy just saved my life. And it's, you know, very incredible thing he's done. And there's nothing, I can't find the right words to say anything, you know, about this. You know, it's just such an incredible, overwhelming, great experience.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then how or why you had to have a bone marrow transplant?
Well, Christmas Eve 2006, I was diagnosed with acute lymphatic leukemia, and wasn't really given much of a chance to live. And I was about May 2007, in April 2007, I was told I would have to get a bone marrow transplant. And in May, I got the bone marrow transplant, and I had to wait in the hospital for 100 days, so it would take. And after that, you know, it was good. And it's getting better and better. But, I was diagnosed with leukemia Christmas Eve and went through a long battle, you know, 12 spinal taps, 8 hip biopsies, an epidural, kidney disease, avascular necrosis, which is degenerative bone disease. I've had both, you know, hips and left shoulder replaced. I've just had several surgeries, and it was definitely worth it all, for sure, you know, because I'm just glad to be alive.
Holy cow, that is a lot of stuff. And so everything is in remission, I imagine.
Yes, it is.
And so since you went through so much, and how do you think you were able to survive that much? Like, is it all about attitude and mind, and what was it?
I guess it was just, you know, going through it day by day, you know, session by session, you know. If I knew I had a spinal tap that day, I would just, you know, wait it out, do what I had to do, and then rest after. So it was, you know, a lot of ups and downs and pain, but resting, I guess, was pretty much the key, and having like a very positive attitude. And when I was in the hospital, you know, the doctors would say, just imagine these big good cells attacking the little bad cells, you know. And you know, that was another one of the things that stuck with me. There was a few other things, but that was one of the big ones that stuck with me, was, you know, just the power of positivity and how it can, you know, really help you overcome what you're going through. And you know, having a positive outlook and attitude is really key for survival, I think.
Well, that's pretty incredible. And with respect to that, do you have any advice for others out there who may be suffering through cancer or leukemia and any other diseases?
Yes. Well, a few things first before I get into that is I wish everybody, you know, that's listening to this, would go out and get their blood checked on a frequent basis. Getting your blood work done is key to life, you know. Blood donations, bone marrow donations are also very vital right now for people all across the world. You never know if your DNA could match that of somebody else, like a little child in Australia or somewhere in Europe or Asia, you know, and you could be saving their life. With people going through it, you just got to live day to day and know that you're better than the disease and that you can get through it. And know that, just know that, you know, there's always good days, and just to enjoy what you have, and know that, you know, life is a beautiful thing and it is a definite gift and it is worth fighting for.
That was Dave DeCara Jr., a Miccosukee Cree member who calls California home. You've been listening to Bomb Siddaw with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bomb Siddaw is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddaw means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsedaw.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddaw.